Hello and welcome to Press TV's debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the 29th International Islamic Unity Conference is underway in the Iranian capital of Tehran. Muslim scholars and high-ranking Shia and Sunni officials from many countries are in attendance. No time could be better than now to look at the issue of unity amongst the Muslims. Perhaps it is significant, however, that when the Islamic Republic was just 7 years old, the leadership saw the importance of unity when it wasn't even talked about elsewhere. Stay with us as we take a look at the Unity Conference and its significance.
The event has brought together prominent Muslim figures, ministers of Islamic countries, clerics, scholars, and representatives of scientific and cultural circles from Iran and across the Islamic world. The main purpose of the 29th International Islamic Unity Conference is to discuss ways to promote unity and solidarity in the Islamic world and bring closer the views of Muslim clerics and scholars on different issues.
Every year, the International Islamic Unity Conference takes place on the auspicious occasion of the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which marks the Muslims' Unity Week.
The conference also focuses on problems which have beset the Islamic world, particularly the threats posed by the Takfir thoughts and terrorist groups.
Unfortunately, for the time being, we are facing different disputes in different parts of the Islamic world, specifically in the Middle East and the northern part of Africa, specifically in Syria and Iraq and Yemen. We as the Muslims should help together to overcome these differences which are available among the Muslims and fighting against terrorism.
Addressing the opening ceremony of the conference, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has warned that only Israel benefits from divisions and conflicts in the Muslim world. The Iranian president criticized certain Muslim countries for spending huge amounts of money on U.S. arms and either delivering them to militant groups or using them against other Muslim nations.
Is the undermining of Syria benefiting the Muslim world? Is the undermining of Syria benefiting the Muslim neighbors of Syria? Is destroying Syria benefiting Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, or the United Arab Emirates? Who is pleased with the destruction in Syria except Israel? The war in Iraq is benefiting no side except Israel and those who are acting against Muslims.
The participants are also scheduled to discuss the issue of Palestine, propose solutions to settle its problems, and adopt a common stance on this issue. Unity among the Islamic nations is viewed as the most effective formula for countering the enemies of Muslims, especially at a time when the Takfir groups are distorting the image of Islam in the name of religion. Saman Kujuri, Press TV, Tehran.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program right here in Tehran, Adjunct Professor Carleton University, Mr. Hamid Mousavi, and out of London, Professor, University of Buckingham, Mr. Jeffrey Alderman. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in London with Professor Alderman. Does it show the vision that the Islamic Republic had from almost the beginning of its existence, that even when it was involved in a war with Iraq, that it stressed the importance of unity?
I think that is significant. There's no question that the rise of the Islamic Republic has posed grave logistical and indeed theological challenges for the Muslim world. I've recently was interested in very senior Iranian spokespersons condemning the Islamic Republic. And I think this is an issue which, at the end of the day, only the Islamic world can deal with.
Well, Mr. Mousavi, the Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said it is only Israel which benefits from the division taking place in the Islamic world. Your take on this?
It's no secret that the instability in both Syria and Iraq is greatly helping the Israelis. These wars have not only eliminated potential adversaries to Israel, but they have also preoccupied Israel's main rivals in the region, being Iran and Hezbollah. So definitely the wars in Syria and Iraq have greatly aided Israeli interests in the region.
How do you see it, Mr. Alderman? What do you think? I want your perspective on the relationship of Israel with all of this. And what would be the goal, you think, for Tel Aviv in the way that it deals with Muslim nations, as many of these Muslim nations would say that Israel actually is the root of the majority of chaos in the region?
Well, they might say that Israel is at the root of the majority of chaos in the region, but the rise of the Islamic Republic, even though I would agree with my colleague just now that the very bloody and terrible civil war in Syria and Iraq is certainly of a tactical benefit to the Jewish state, I don't think you can put the rise of the Islamic Republic at the feet of the Israeli government. That said, as I've said before on Press TV, from Israel's perspective, the greater threat has always come from the north, not from the south. That's to say from Syria, from Iraq, from the Lebanon, not from Egypt. In the long run, even Israelis, I think, recognize that chaos in Syria and Iraq is not to their benefit, because you never know which particular group in this terrible civil war might turn out to come out victorious.
Well, your take on that, Mr. Mousavi, do you feel that Israel is the biggest culprit? And if so, as far as causing chaos in the region, what other countries are the main culprits in aiding in Tel Aviv regime's plan of creating this chaos?
I think the Israelis have played a huge role in shaping American foreign policy in the region. It's no secret that the Americans, with the help of their allies in the region, being Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, have greatly aided arming, training, as well as funding terrorist groups such as ISIS. Only recently have they started to change their policies, but even that is doubtful. Israel itself, there's been confirmed reports, including an acknowledgement by its defense minister actually this summer, that they have been providing medical aid to the Al-Nusra Front, which is actually Al-Qaeda's branch in Syria. So I think it's really not a stretch to say that Israel has been playing a very important role in the conflict, especially in Syria.
What about that, Mr. Alderman? Doesn't that show we do know that Israelis treated many of those who had been wounded, the terrorists who had been wounded in Syria? Why would they treat them unless they are allied with them? So do you not think that that is one aspect of it that proves Israel's allegiance or alliance, I should say, with the terrorists themselves?
I have to say, I find this argument a little astonishing. If Israel did not treat the victims of terrorism, you might ask me to come on a program on Press TV and condemn Israel for not doing this. This is a game Israel cannot win. That said, my understanding of the conflict that has engulfed large parts of Syria and Iraq is that this is at its basis a religious war within Islam, in which the perceived grievances of the Sunni minority in Iraq play a large part. And I simply fail to see how you can honestly lay that at Israel's door.
Mr. Mousavi, your take on his comments?
Well, actually, these men who have been treated within Israel are not victims of terrorism. A simple search on Google will show that Israel has actually acknowledged that 90% of these people are actually male fighters who are fighting in Syria. So they haven't been treating so-called civilians. Also, there's been confirmed reports by UN troops stationed in the Golan Heights that Israel has actually had deep relations with the fighters in southern Syria. So I don't think I would completely disagree with Dr. Alderman on this issue.
Well, Dr. Alderman, you said that this is an internal Islamic dispute. However, we look at Daesh, and if you see as far as what this entity has been doing, anyone who is Muslim and know anything about Islam know that this entity is the farthest thing away from Islam, and actually the majority of its victims have been Muslims. So, how do you say that this is actually an internal dispute between Islam, as opposed to what many experts say, that this entity has been created to actually cause chaos in the Muslim community?
But madam, you yourself have just said that the majority of victims of Daesh have been fellow Muslims. So this leads me to suppose that what we are faced with is a civil war within Islam. I am not by any manner of means an expert in Islamic theology, but it, from the reports that I have read, Daesh can trace its origins to grievances, which may have been real grievances, by the Sunni minority in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. We can all agree that after the fall of Saddam Hussein, there was a dangerous vacuum which was filled by a Shia supremacy that sidelined the Sunni minority with inevitable consequences. That said, we all know that one of the aims of Daesh, after dealing with Shia Muslims, is to kill all the Jews that it can. That is a stated policy of Daesh. That cannot be in Israel's interest.
And Professor Alderman, I did say that the majority of them have been Muslims. Thus, how could that be an Islamic entity? But Professor Mousavi, your take, please. I want your perspective on what Professor Alderman has said.
It's very true that the rise of Daesh in Iraq took place after the fall of Saddam Hussein. So that's a very accurate statement. However, what is missing in that statement is all this happened out of the invasion of Iraq, the illegal invasion of Iraq, for that matter, by the United States. In fact, the United States just left Iraq a couple of years ago. So the mess we see in Iraq today should be laid on the illegal invasion by the Americans. In fact, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of Daesh, was arrested by the Americans, but he was let go shortly after. So the rise of Daesh in Iraq has been partly, at least, a responsibility of the United States. Even when they moved to Syria and started the civil war there, they were heavily supported by American allies such as Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar. And of course, these are well-known facts. They were even acknowledged by the US Vice President Joe Biden. So I think the Americans need to take some responsibility for the rise of Daesh, and this needs to be addressed by Islamic countries as well as perhaps by the United Nations.
Well, Professor Alderman, we have entered a time where Islamophobia is becoming more rampant in many Western countries. Do you think that distorting the true picture of Islam has been done on purpose? Excuse me.
Do I think the distortion of Islam has been done on purpose? I think there are some entities in the Western world who do see that a distortion of Islam is a useful way of making mischief for various political ends. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
When my colleague lays some of the blame for the rise of Daesh at the feet of the United States of America, I can actually agree with him. I think American foreign policy in that whole region has been one disaster, a catalogue of disasters, one disaster after another. But it's a very big step from saying that some of the blame for the rise of Daesh can be laid at the door of Washington, D.C., to saying that somehow this is an Israeli conspiracy.
And what do, staying with you, Mr. Alderman, what do you think Western leaders and others fear about Islam the most?
What they fear about Islam is that it is more than simply a religion. that it is a political entity with a religious dimension. And that basically, whether you are Shia, Sunni, Alawite, Ismaili, basically Islamic values are contrary to what we might think of here in Britain as British values.
What do you mean by that? Can you expand on that? Can you expand on the aspect of which Islamic values contradict those values in the West?
Yes. The freedom to give offence, which is a very basic component of British values here in the United Kingdom. Now, Islam, rightly or wrongly, I'm not taking sides in this, regards the freedom to give offence as not worthy of the name freedom at all. Democracy, I have heard reputable Islamic scholars here in London saying that basically democracy is not an Islamic value. Now, that could be right, that could be wrong, but you ask me, well, what does the West fear about Islam? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to give you an honest answer to this. Democracy, as I understand it, here in the United Kingdom, is not an Islamic value.
Mr. Mousavi, what's your take on? Do you see the values in Islam or what Muslims should adhering to in stark contrast or contradiction to what many would consider Western values?
I think that democracy is not necessarily against Islam. I mean, it might be true that democracy cannot be taken out of Islam, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the two concepts are contradictory. Nevertheless, what I would add to what Dr. Alderman was saying is I believe even though if the values of the West as well as Islam are not really the same, and even if they are not compatible, there should still be tolerance of religion as well as Islamophobia created in Europe and in the United States is actually harming a lot of innocent Muslims, which basically have nothing to do with terrorist groups such as Daesh.
Well, what about that, Mr. Alderman? It seems that, especially after the invasion of, we're talking about the U.S. invasion from Afghanistan and then to Iraq, and of course what has happened in the region since then, that this caused the area totally to be destabilized and gave rise to these terrorist entities that did not exist before these projects by the United States took place. So at this point in time, that so many people have lost their lives, what we're talking about from Iraq to Syria and so many other places, tell me overall the responsibility that the United States should take for this whole destabilization project. And now what should there be the responsibility in order to try to help fix the problem that they have created?
These questions that you ask are very important. They are fundamental questions. Clearly, as I've already said, American policy in the region has lurched from one disaster to another. In the region, incidentally, I include, of course, Afghanistan. My own view is that as far as is possible, America and its allies, including Britain and France, should withdraw from the Middle East. They should simply withdraw from the Middle East. If there are differences of opinion between various strands of Islam, that they should simply allow these differences to take their course and not interfere in matters that are basically none of their business.
And Mr. Mousavi, your take right now, as I was saying about this Islamic conference that's taking place in Tehran, Unity Conference, based on the birth of Prophet Muhammad and the differences between 5 days when the Sunnis see the birth anniversary and when the Shias, and of course Imam Khomeini in the beginning of the Islamic Revolution named this week as Unity Week. Let's look at that aspect, that Imam Khomeini from the very beginning had stressed the importance of unity. At this point in time, we're headed towards 2016. Do you think that the majority of Muslims understand the importance of this unity and actually are ready to work towards it and sort of sideline or control the Takfiris, who have always just, their goal was dividing the Muslim community. How do you see the future for the Muslim Ummah?
Before I answer that question, I would just like to comment very shortly on what Dr. Alderman said. I completely agree that the West, United States, France, and Britain should withdraw from the region. Unfortunately, however, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. And that's mainly due because they are pursuing their interests in a very oil-rich region. So even though it's a wish, but I don't think it's going to become true anytime soon. Regarding 2016 and the unity of Muslims, I believe that the grand majority of Muslims understand the importance of this unity and have been victims of all of this fighting within Iraq, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan. However, this will all depend on the policies of Islamic countries within the region. So how 2016 is going to be depends on how Islamic countries act in 2016. I hope that countries such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and as well as Turkey, have learned from their past mistakes and hopefully will change their policies in the coming year. However, if they don't change these policies, then the instabilities we see in these countries will perhaps even increase.
All right, and on that note, I'd like to thank both my guests for being with me, Mr. Hamid Mousavi, adjunct professor at Carleton University right here in Tehran, and out of London, Professor University of Buckingham, Mr. Jeffrey Alderman. I appreciate you both being with us.
Thanks.
And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. Join me right here, same time, same place tomorrow. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out. Goodbye.